Today is Friday, the 27th day of May, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, Barack Obama does something a sitting U.S. president has never done.
The memory of the morning of August 6th, 1945, must never fade.
We'll talk with VOA's White House correspondent, Cindy Sain. She's in Hiroshima. How do you get the day's news? The methods are changing. Andrew Palczewski is here with that for you. And almost a million students have come to the United States to attend school from abroad. What do they face? How best do they survive and thrive? We'll talk with the author of a new book about that. It's all on today's International Edition.
71 years ago, on a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky and the world was changed. A flash of light and a wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself.
U.S. President Barack Obama made history today by walking through Hiroshima's Memorial Peace Park with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Hiroshima is the city where an American warplane dropped the world's first atomic bomb on August 6, 1945, during World War II, killing tens of thousands and subjecting a generation to radiation sickness. Joining us is VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain, who was on the scene to witness the solemn ceremony in Hiroshima. Cindy, thanks for doing this. How would you characterize this ceremony?
Well, Ira, it was quite remarkable. It was very powerful, and it was silent. It's a huge park, and so many journalists gathered there, and honestly, it was totally silent as people watched, fascinated. And President Obama, at one point, got very emotional when he was talking about the children of Hiroshima, and the dread and the fear that they must have felt. And I even saw some of the security guards, some people who protect the president, Secret Service, getting emotional.
This was kind of a fine line that the president of the United States had to walk. Can you explain that?
Well, that's right. There were some people who said that he should have gone a long time ago, should apologize for the suffering that the United States caused. Others, including many older Americans who remember the war, veterans groups, said it's not a good idea for the president to go, and said do not apologize because that would somehow lessen the service of many Americans who fought in the Second World War. So it was a very, very difficult balance, but I think the message came across from both him and from Prime Minister Abe that they were just emphasizing the horrors of war and how that they really, both countries, want to do all they can to make sure that something like this never happens again.
And he did not apologize. He didn't use that word once. Is that correct?
That's right. He did not apologize. And he also made it clear that they were mourning the suffering of all the people who died during the Second World War, some 60 million people. So it was a big and inclusive event.
Well, even through their silence, what kind of a reception did the U.S. president get from those there? Was it just that silence? And what did it mean? And what kind of feeling did they express, if at any?
Well, on his way to the park, there were thousands of Japanese lining the streets and waving flags and welcoming the president. Also, polls here show that 89% of Japanese supported President Obama coming. But I think it was just very emotional, the fact that he also, after the ceremony, he went up and had private words and handshake with two survivors of the bombing. And that, the Japanese people that I spoke to said that moved them to tears, the fact that a 91-year-old survivor was able to hug President Obama.
What was his message about nuclear weapons?
Well, his message was that it may seem idealistic, but that we should have the courage to not think in categories of fear. He said we may not see it during our lifetime, but he does envision a world without nuclear weapons.
Cindy Sain is VOA's White House correspondent, traveling with President Obama, has gone through Vietnam now and now in Hiroshima after covering the Group of Seven meeting in Japan. Cindy, thanks so much for being with us as always. Well, International Edition social media guru Andrew Palshevsky is here, as he is with us every week. What kind of reaction is the president's visit to Hiroshima getting on social media?
Well, we're seeing a lot of the clips from the speech, people putting up little videos of the key moments, the key lines from the president's speech. But Cindy mentioned that the president didn't give an apology in the speech. But there are a lot of people on social media that are debating that. They said, well, he didn't explicitly apologize, but are some of the things he said kind of apologetic? And there was one person who, reporting on social media, talked to a Hiroshima survivor who said, well, I think that that was a sufficient apology that he gave. So there's a lot of back and forth, some of it politically charged about whether this was an apology. There are some people that are saying, well, it's great that we are moving forward, that it's something that we need to do, even if it wasn't explicitly said. Other people saying, well, we're past that. We don't need to apologize. It makes us look weak. So it is a little back and forth on that, on this Hiroshima
speech.
That's
one of the good things about social media. You get good sides of everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether they're, we consider them good or not, I don't know. But news, how people get their news. Hopefully a lot of people are getting their news from us right now. But there's a study out that says more and more people are getting it another way.
Yeah, or from our social media,
yes,
maybe.
Yeah.
Because this Pew Research study found that for the first time, a majority of American adults get their news from social media. 62% of those surveyed in this study said that they use social media to get news, 44% on Facebook. And they had a bunch of other little stats in there. One I found interesting, 70% of users of the website Reddit say they use that website to get their news. It's kind of a message board where people can post topics and have a back and forth debate. And there are subreddits for all different kinds of categories and all different kinds of news events. So it is kind of a shifting trend, but a lot of people on social media saying, of course we go to social media to get news. Doesn't everybody go there? So it is interesting to see that. Maybe they're a little biased because they're saying that on Twitter and on Facebook. So,
well, and tell people where they can find us on social media.
Absolutely. Well, you're at VOA Mellman.
Right.
And,
M-E-L-L-M-A-N.
Yes, yeah. And I am at APAL, APAL. And you can also follow International Edition at VOA_IE.
Andrew, thank you so much. Talk
thank
to you,
you
again real soon. Have
Sounds
a good weekend.
Good. Thanks, you too.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by British and American scientists has found that there may not be as many livable extrasolar planets as had been thought. These are Earth-like planets that orbit its sun in its habitable zone. In other words, from a distance that would allow water to exist on them in liquid form. That's something that's vital to the creation and survival of all life on Earth. When looking for potentially life-friendly planets, scientists usually focus on those that circle a star like Earth does with the sun. Writing in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, the scientists found, despite orbiting their stars in the habitable zone, a number of these planets have atmospheres so thick that they're too hot to host life. The atmospheres of many of these exoplanets are so thick that the air makes up about 1% of the exoplanet's mass. Earth's atmosphere, by comparison, comprises only 1/1,000,000th of its mass. A huge difference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Let's check some of the top stories in the world. Barack Obama made history, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima. Leaders of the Group of Seven wealthiest economies called global growth their urgent priority at the close of their summit in Japan. The United Nations Nuclear Agency reports Iran is complying with a milestone agreement to limit stockpiles of key ingredients that can be used to produce nuclear weapons. The European Union has extended sanctions against the government of the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad by another year because it says that repression continues unabated. Expanded coverage of all of these and more on the VOAnews.com website, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Time now to check in with International Edition's money reporter, Jill Malandrino, to see what the markets are doing on this Friday. A couple of smiles heading into what is a holiday weekend here in the United States. Hey, Jill?
Yes, we will be off as well as London on Monday. They will be observing their late May bank holiday. So two of the globe's largest markets will be closed. And going into it, things look pretty good in the U.S., although we're on very light volume. Most traders have packed up essentially Friday to head out early to the Hamptons or the Jersey Shore. And so it's a good sign that we're seeing the markets relatively stable because there are a couple things that we'll be focusing on in June. For example, the interest rate hike, which could potentially happen on June 15th when the FOMC meets. We also have the OPEC meeting next week on June 2nd, which will certainly have an impact on oil. And finally, the Brexit vote on June 23rd. So there's three key macro events going into June that I think the market has had some time to digest, which is why we're possibly not seeing so much volatility. I would also say that we've seen strength in the market because of the interest rate hikes. That's good for the financial sector. So you're seeing stocks like JP Morgan, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs do well because bank margins improve as interest rates are higher. And because we've been operating in a historically low interest rate environment, the banks have been under pressure. It's a big component of the S&P 500. That, coupled with the strength we've been seeing in crude oil, lended to some pretty healthy bullish action this week.
Well, it was about time because we saw some down action over the past few weeks. However, overall, the market's still up, is it not, from a long time?
Yeah, it's up just a flat to about a percent on the year, which it doesn't sound like much, but considering we're up 15% from the February 11 low, that's quite a move. And you know what? I'll take a flat market versus down 15%. And this is why we always tell long-term investors, keep your powder dry. It's an expression that we use, and let the market find its own averages. Ups and downs is what makes averages. And that's what we care about within our 20, 30, 40-year outlook as we look into retirement.
Jill, have yourself a great holiday weekend.
Thank you.
We'll see you again next week. Talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
That is Jill Malandrino, and this is VOA.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Ira Melman on International Edition. I'm in Washington. The latest count reported in the Open Doors report, that's from the Institute of International Education, says there are about 1 million foreign students studying in the United States. That's about a year ago when that came out. A question being asked by a new book is, are these students prepared for their experience when they get here? Now, we welcome to International Edition the author of the book, Stacy Nevendomsky-Burdan. The book is called, appropriately, Preparing to Study in the USA. Stacy, along with Alan Goodman at the Institute of International Education, has written a series of books aimed at helping those who seek education on an international stage. Stacy, thanks for being with us. What are the most important things for a student to know as he or she is preparing to head to the U.S. to study?
Well, that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, was to try to kind of boil everything down, because it's obviously a very big step to take. And that's why this book we wrote in 15 different chapters, the 15 different things they need to know. And a couple of the most important ones, although that's why we chose 15, couldn't break it down even further, was the first is to understand that the U.S. education system is not like most any in the world. There isn't a central system of ministry to kind of put all the guidelines together. So each university or college operates differently than each other. There's no systematic approach, different state universities, private universities, public universities. So it can be very confusing. So figuring out what the system is all about and how it works is one of the first steps to then identifying which campus, which area of study will be best for an international student. And then I would say the second is to know and realize that U.S. offers what is called a liberal education. That means we inspire creativity, innovation, free thinking. Students are encouraged to question their professors and ask questions and debate, of course, all in a polite way, which is very different from what a lot of international students are used to around the world and can make people feel kind of uncomfortable if they don't know to expect that. And I guess the third, I would say, is to really integrate once you're here. Don't live with a bunch of students like you from your country, but to figure out how best to matriculate, make with other students, to make friends with other people, to take advantage of all of the amazing resources that U.S. universities and colleges have to offer.
Now, are any U.S. colleges better than others for foreign students? And why is that? I know you might not want to name colleges, but if you want to, go right ahead. I'm sure people would want to know. What is the answer to that question?
Well, I wouldn't consider myself an expert on which college or university is better for an international student, because I think, like all schools, all universities and colleges, it's very specific to the student. What is it that you want to study? How is it that you handle this subject or that subject? There is no doubt that the colleges and universities over the last 5 years, maybe 10, really 5 years, have really been focused on trying to help international students integrate better, to have international students counseling services on campuses. The vast majority have those. So I would say any university or college who has a dedicated team of experts, professionals, counselors, academics on campus to help the students integrate would be one of the best things to do, because coming here, it is a cross-cultural experience. It is a different experience. These students are young, especially if they're coming as undergraduate, 18, 19, 20 years old. And so for those universities and colleges that have that kind of expertise, it would be terrific.
What kind of problems do a lot of students run into? Any specifics that you can tell us about?
I think there has been a cottage industry that has grown very popular around the world, with people saying, oh, we can help you get into this university or this college in the United States, just pay us lots of money. We advise in our book, and IIE does, and Education USA does, which is offices in the embassies and consulates around the world, not to pay people to help you, to actually go to an Education USA office in your country, you know, at the U.S. embassy or consulate closest to you. So I would say don't pay someone to help you, because that's not what this is about. This is about you need to make sure that you're proficient to a certain level in English, and there are standardized tests to determine that. You will need to go through the admissions process and fill out the paperwork. But the Education USA offices are actually designed to help international students do that. It's a branch of the U.S. government. They're not going to help you get into one school or another, but they're going to be able to clarify, answer questions, advise you, because this is different. So I think it's really important that students actually look to that resource, because it's a tremendous resource with, as you said, almost a million students coming here. It's getting more and more competitive for students who want to come. But I think people set their sights on getting into one college or another because they've heard of Harvard or Yale or Stanford, when there are almost 5,000 fabulous colleges and universities across the country, and every one of them has something special for certain individual students.
Stacy Novodomsky-Burdan is the author of a book called Preparing to Study in the USA. Stacy, thanks so much for being with us. And her book is now available on Amazon. As David Byrd of International Edition now tells us, a group called Above and Beyond have traded their turntables for headphones and harps and pianos and guitars.
Most of the time when you attend an Above and Beyond show, you get something like this. That's what the trio, John O. Grant, Tony McGinnis, and Paavo Siljamaki, brought to more than 1 million people on a beach in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But it's their acoustic recordings that have gotten them into some of the most prestigious venues in the world. They released an unplugged album featuring some of their hits 2 years ago to good success. However, Paavo Siljamaki says the group wanted to do more.
It left us with a real sort of itch to do it again. It felt like we hadn't done enough, or it was nicer than we had initially predicted to play together, and then to have an audience like we had at the Greek really made sense of it all. So that was really why we decided to do acoustic, to really to have a chance to do it again.
During their current tour, the band has sold out the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, the Sydney, Australia Opera House, and the Hollywood Bowl. Electronic DJs usually cannot play such venues because of volume restrictions. But Tony McGinnis says the acoustic concerts have opened a door the group never thought it would go through.
We sort of Trojan horse our way into some of these incredibly prestigious venues. I mean, we walked on stage at the Greek Theater having only done 4 gigs, really. And what band gets to do the Greek Theatre after doing 4 gigs? I can't think of any, you know. We kind of leapfrogged all that kind of years of trailing around the small clubs by bringing our electronic audience to these acoustic venues. We were in heaven, you and I. And when I lay with you and close my eyes, our fingers touch the sky.
During its current tour, Above and Beyond is traveling with a 15-piece ensemble. Tony McGinnis sings and plays guitar, mandolin, and ukulele. Paavo Siliamaki plays the piano, vibraphone, and cello. Jono Grant plays the Rhodes piano, guitar, and vibes. When they play the Hollywood Bowl, Above and Beyond will perform with a full 32-piece orchestra. Paavo Siliamaki says the idea of performing at the storied venue still seems unreal.
And I know the electronic and the acoustic are connected, but the fact that, you know, it took us 15 years of touring to be able to, you know, do a show at the Madison Square Garden, and here we are with
David Byrd talking with us, and thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, Mark Ferguson. I'm Ira Melman. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The International Syria Support Group announced after its recent meeting that all parties, including Russia and Iran, have agreed to strengthen the cessation of hostilities, to ensure humanitarian access in Syria, and to move toward a political transition. The challenge we now face, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, is to transform these possibilities into a reality of an agreement. The first step is to transform the cessation of hostilities into a comprehensive ceasefire. In a statement, the International Syria Support Group, or ISSG, called on all groups to stop the indiscriminate use of force. We welcome Russia's commitment to work with the Syrian authorities to halt aerial bombardments over areas predominantly inhabited by civilians or parties to the cessation, said Secretary Kerry. The ISSG statement also calls on all parties to the cessation of hostilities to disassociate themselves physically and politically from Daesh and al-Nusra. To that end, the U.S. remains committed to helping prevent the flow of foreign fighters, weapons, and financial support to terrorist organizations. The delivery of humanitarian assistance to Syria remains of supreme importance. Starting June 1st, if the United Nations is denied humanitarian access to any areas in need, the ISSG calls on the World Food Program to carry out a campaign of air bridges and airdrops. In addition, the World Food Program will accelerate airdrops in Deir al-Zour, where it has already provided some 460 metric tons of food to more than 100,000 people. Aid to these areas, said Secretary Kerry, must be a step towards a full, sustained, and unimpeded access throughout Syria. And finally, there must be substantive discussions on reaching a framework agreement for a political transition in Syria by August 1st. Those talks should address the structure, membership, operational rules, and roles and responsibilities of a broad, non-sectarian, transitional governing body. The fate of millions of Syrians hangs in the balance. That's why it's critical that all parties to the conflict immediately implement the steps agreed to by the International Syria Support Group.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.